to enter the fun-filled pageant. Final application date is February 1st, and that is when the adventure begins. Application forms are available at the Northwood Building office in the lobby or at the counter of the News Miner. Sign up now. You are wanted. The lovely girl you are now viewing is Miss Joan Huvel, our contestant for this evening for the 1962 Miss Fairbanks title. She is 18 years old, 5 feet 6 inches tall, and weighs 123 pounds. She has brown hair, blue eyes, and measures in at 35, 25, 36. Joan's sponsor is the Fairlanes Bowl, the Bowler's Bowling Alley. I'd like to call your attention to the bowling ball here on the table. It's the all-new plastic ball, the Columbia 300, and may be obtained from Joan's sponsor, Fairlanes Bowl.
Good evening, Joan. Welcome to the 26th Annual Miss Fairbanks Contest. Representing the Community Recreation League, I am Sally Murphy. To my far right, Marion Strait, our guest, Mrs. Jane Grice, and of course, our lovely Miss Joan Huvel. Joan, what was your first reaction to the contest?
I was extremely pleased to be invited by my friends into the contest, and I hope to meet many Fairbanksons and have a wonderful adventure.
Tell us a little about your activities right now.
I'm presently a senior at Lathrop High School, and I'm going to be in the Caperettes at the annual Arctic Capers put on by the senior high school group, senior class. We are giving our Arctic Capers show later in February, and we have a wonderful theme in store for you, and we hope that you will all come to it too.
Joan, are you working part-time?
Yes, I'm presently employed at the Alaskan Flower and Gift Shop, my mother's store, where I've met many tourists through the past couple of years from all over the United States and parts of Europe. I enjoy chatting with them very much.
And you are a senior this year. You will be graduating in May.
Yes,
what are your plans for summer and the fall?
My plans for this summer, I'm going to work and earn enough money so that I can enter the University of Alaska, where I will major in behavioral sciences and or education.
Right. What hobbies do you enjoy? Do you have any special Alaskan hobbies?
Well, I love to sew. My favorite sewing is embroidering, and I'm learning to knit just a little. I also, in the summer, enjoy water skiing. I'm learning to slalom ski now. I tried that last summer. It was just wonderful. I also like to go fishing and camping.
Do you bowl?
Yes, I do. My average is about 110. I don't get to as much as I'd like to.
And what type of music do you enjoy?
My favorites are by Tchaikovsky, Irving Berlin, and Rodgers and Hammerstein.
This is something a bit different for a teenager, I'm sure. How do you like the twist?
Well, I think it's a marvelous exercise.
Have you had any experience doing the twist?
Yes, we're learning that at the school for one of our activities.
Oh, fine. And I know that you do some modeling as a hobby. Would you tell us about your experience and your training?
Well, I have taken lessons from a lady who was up from Seattle and had a few pointers from Katie Rotuck. And Mrs. Grice has been helping me also.
Yes, and for whom have you modeled before?
I modeled for Gladys Morris quite a few times. I've been in Quarter Club's annual Sham Fashional the past couple of years, which I've enjoyed immensely.
Do you have any future plans for your modeling?
No, I don't think I will dwell on it as a major. I'm more interested in my college education and possibly visiting Europe. My aspirations, which I may not accomplish all of, but which I hope to.
Mm-hmm. You do enjoy it as a hobby, though, I'm sure. Do you belong to any clubs or organizations in or out of school?
Yes, I am presently a station of charity in the Order of the Rainbow for Girls. I enjoy that very much, and I've enjoyed my 6 years of being in Rainbow and contributing to it and learning from it.
What are your ambitions now? We know that you're going to be graduating this fall, and you said that you would be interested in going to the university. I mean, you will be graduating this spring and going to the university this fall.
I will also like to raise a large family.
Oh, well, that will come with time, I'm sure. Thank you, Joan. I know in talking with Joan and the other contestants, it's been a pleasure to see such beauty, and beauty being only the first asset, we have also found graciousness, poise, and even a slight reserve in these girls, which sometimes brings about a little bit of difficulty in getting these girls to talk freely about themselves. But we hope with these interviews with each contestant to acquaint you, the public, with each one of our girls. Marion?
Thank you, Sally. I'd now like to talk with the other lovely lady that we have with us this evening, Mrs. Jane Grice. She's had much experience in fashion and photography modeling, and she will be conducting the classes that the girls will be taking, that are contestants. Mrs. Grice, just what do you hope to accomplish with these girls with your professional training?
Well, in the short time of training we will have, from the beginning of February until March, our instruction will not even attempt to teach all the phases of the modeling profession. Our main concern is in preparing all of the girls to feel enough confidence to present themselves to the public in an appealing light. To do this, we will help to develop three important factors: grace of carriage, poise of presentation, and confidence in self. To illustrate these, grace of carriage, for instance, in this, we will practice posture, some of the techniques of walking, standing, and posing. As for poise of presentation, this will cover the small things that lead to looking natural. What to do with our hands and our arms, a natural smile, with immense detail on the usage of the hands. If not properly used, the hands can become very awkward looking. Confidence of self, this is important. And
Bill Reed, chairman of...
does have the ability to appear in public as she would like to appear in public. And merely by being an attractive young lady, she can do it. Then, when she is on stage, you as her audience cannot see exactly how nervous she is. From past experiences, I personally have found all young girls have an inborn desire to be graceful. Most young girls have a natural grace, some confidence, and a little poise. Our program sounds very simple, really. Just these three points, though, that I have illustrated, take constant practice, not only in classes, but in everyday living. Each contestant will be encouraged to be conscious of every movement, every moment she makes until they become perfectly natural. Of course, we will include makeup, hair styling, and caring for your own hair. Good grooming. The young ladies I've seen so far have quite a bit of knowledge on this subject already. There is one thing, though, that I would like to add. We do not want these young ladies, under any circumstances, to become unnatural. Everything and anything we do will be only to improve and develop those qualities which make them the individual person they are.
That's most interesting, Mrs. Grice, and really sounds quite exciting. You know, there's some things I've always wondered about models. May I ask you?
Yes, of course. What is that?
How do you know where to step when you don't seem to be looking at your feet?
Well, we sneak, I'll tell you, because as a general rule, we will take and have a sneak peek before we go on a stage, and then as we're walking along, we will gently drop our eyes.
How clever you are. I suppose it's all in knowing how.
Yes,
one other thing I've wondered, perhaps you could tell me, are these younger girls like Joan that she will be teaching pretty well set in the makeup that they wear, or are they still experimenting?
Well, I think that most of them are still experimenting, but they are doing a very good job of it, I'll tell you.
I think I would have guessed so. Something else that I've always been curious about, maybe you could tell me, a model's hand always looks so graceful and so really, well, elegant. Is there How's this done?
Well, that, as I just said before, is done with constant practice. Any time that a model is before a camera or before an audience, she will usually see if she can present either this side of the hand or this side of the hand. That includes the arms. The arms must be just as becoming as the hands. If they aren't, one purpose is lost to the other.
You're so right. Thank you a lot for your information. Perhaps there's something else that, you could give us some, little tips on in this same line. I mentioned there's lots of, interesting things.
Yes, and I have a wonderful idea.
Good, I'm so glad.
Let's have our lovely young lady who is present with us this evening illustrate to us some of the phases of the modeling profession. She has done quite a bit of work in it, and she also takes great pride in what she does. As you can see with her now, she is trying to give you an impression of her hands, and watch, Debbie. Now, would you please strike another pose for us directly to the camera? Thank you, and would you, do you think you could follow her forward and put the camera as she walks forward, and do a pivot for us? Every time she makes a turn, she strikes a pose. Any time she moves, her movement are a pose. Do you think, Mr. Photographer, can you catch her feet at all? Now watch her movement of her feet. Would you take three steps forward and make a pivot? Now three steps back. You see how she lends to tends to go towards the ball of her foot when she walks. And she stops again, she gave you another pose. Every time she moves, she will pose. She smiles, it's a natural smile. It takes, which I assure you, she is nervous. But she does not appear to be so. And that is our main aim. Anytime these girls are in bathing suits particularly, they must show to their finest advantage. And by striking a different pose every few moments in that suit while they are walking, they can do this. You notice how her hips are never, never out of alignment. They always go in with the rest of her body.
25. First to be seated will be the town's beloved city hostess, Eva McGowan, in whose honor a St. Patrick's Day ball will provide fun and merriment for Alaskans and visitors alike. Second will be a Queen Regent. We find that Eva McGowan was selected as the Queen Regent at a Pioneer's Tea held recently. And Edward Farrell was chosen as King Regent. Third will be the beautiful Carnival Queen herself, who will be chosen for her beauty and her charm to reign over the balance of the celebration. If the Carnival has three queens, it has two kings. We named one, Edward Farrell, who was chosen King Regent. The other one is Snow. Snow is king during the carnival, and it'll be a week in Fairbanks and providing a dynamic theme for scores of activities ranging from dog mushing to ice sculpture. With more than $15,000 in prizes offered, dog mushers from all over Alaska and even the other states make the North American Championship Sled Dog Derby one of the most hotly contested on the continent. So exciting and so fun to watch are these races that no other carnival activities are scheduled which would conflict with the races. But they have planned lots of other activities, too. There'll be fireworks displays, for instance, that will rival the Northland's famed Northern Lights for skylighting brilliance, as will a torchlight parade down Fairbanks' main streets after dark. During the daylight hours when the races aren't running, the fascinating and unusual art of ice sculpture will be demonstrated at nearby University of Alaska. Done with hot water and chisels, the sculpture provides a fun-filled challenge for everyone. To promote a better understanding of Alaska winter sports in general and the Fairbanks Ice Carnival in particular, the management is publishing a 36-page booklet called The Challenge of Alaska, which they will sell for $1. Orders for the booklet may be addressed to Ice Carnival, care of Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce here in Fairbanks.
There is now through Wednesday and temperatures below normal. Normal meaning about minus 20 for the low and about zero for the high. And as you can see, we're considerably below that right now. But bitter as the picture may be, that's the weather to the moment. If there are any
New changes, you will be able to see them at 10:30 tonight when Jan Bradner comes in. We hope to see you then.
This is Clyde Burkett, chairman of the Pioneer Visiting Committee, and we're in room 202, and we're just about to interview an old-timer here, Jimmy Maloney.
Hi, Jimmy.
Would you like to say a few words, Jimmy?
You just talk at that thing, Jim.
Well, those two men came in here with an infernal machine of some kind, taking down some notes, and I don't know what they're doing.
Where was you born, Jim?
In Ireland.
You know, remember what town?
In Carconshire, a county Tipperary.
Yeah? And how old are you now, Jim? What date were you born at that time?
November the 4th, 88.
1888?
Yes.
What year did you come into the United States then?
1909.
You come right to Alaska?
I came to Alaska to visit my father.
Father was here. What year did he come in? You don't remember that.
He came up to the west in the early 90s.
In the 90s?
Yes. And he came up through British Columbia.
You walked then, all the way in. Dad traveled on foot.
Well, yes. But of course, he...
Take it real slow, Jim.
Well, I can't.
Yeah, you just take faith. Yeah.
No, that... He came up through Rosslyn, Sandon, and Nelson. And he was up around the Skeena River Valley.
The Keene River?
The Skeena River, yes. When Dawson was discovered.
When Dawson was discovered.
And he had to go to Dawson. But I just, it was just a short time in Dawson when Fritz Miller discovered Atlin in
British Columbia.
Yeah, yes. He went to Athens in
1899.
Yes. 1899. He stayed in Athens a year, came back to Dawson, and came down to the 40 mile in 1900. From the 40 mile, he came to Fairbanks and remained in Fairbanks until he died about 10 years ago.
He lived quite old then.
Yes.
Did they bury him in Fairbanks too?
No, we're out in the country all the time.
Went to work for NC how long ago?
Oh, just a short time ago.
Where did you work when you first come in the country? Mining?
Yes, everybody worked at mining. Mm-hmm. We were prospecting all the time.
Yeah. I guess good life, Jimmy?
A wonderful life.
You wouldn't trade it for any place else, would you?
Oh, no, I wouldn't think of it.
How long have you known Mr. Burkett?
I've known him on Terry Hill.
Tell me something about Mr. Burkett. We haven't got anything on him.
Mr. Burkett is a very Toastmasters man. I think that he is related to one president we had. He was just like Cal, you remember?
Oh, yeah. Calvin Coolidge.
Yes. Well, he and Mr. Burkett are in the same category.
That's nice. Great part of it is
that. Well, but we did it really with this thing here.
Listen, Jimmy, I'm going to play this back to you so you know what it sounds like. That was Jimmy Maloney, a former employee of MC and waited on me for many years. And this is Harry Hughes. And this is room 202 of the St. Joseph's Hospital. And we appreciate hearing from Jimmy. And the date today was May the 29th, 1960, Fairbanks, Alaska. Now this is Harry Hughes and Clyde Burkett on the Pioneer Igloo for Sick and Disabled Visiting Committee. And we're in the house, the home of Julian and Mrs. Hurley at 153 3rd in Fairbanks, Alaska. And this is May the 29th, 1960. And this is Mr. Julian Hurley. Now, Julian, we got to go all over again. We didn't have it on the tape before. Your full name.
My full name is Julian Allen Hurley. Mm-hmm. And I was born on the first of July.
First of April,
1885, in Mariel County, Yamhill County, Oregon. Yes, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And studied law in the office of Colonel R. D. Wheeler.
Wheeler.
Mm-hmm.
Is he alive today?
No, no.
He passed away.
Yeah, he was past 60 when he died. About not very long after I was admitted.
Mm-hmm. And you come to Alaska?
Came to Alaska about 1922.
Mm-hmm. And your first place you come to in Alaska?
Anchorage, Alaska, where I was appointed assistant United States attorney.
Mm-hmm. Who was living in Anchorage when you were there, if you remember?
Well, there was it was only about three or four lawyers in Anchorage. Jerry Murphy and Jerry Murphy was there, and it was shortly after I came there. And
David,
and that's about all. Who was Warrer. J.L. Warrer was there. Right. I remember they took the census in Anchorage.
You took the census?
No, they took it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was there.
While you were there?
Yeah, and there was 1,200 people.
1,200 people in that area?
In the Anchorage area.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. We were there just 3 years ago. in the fake it yet here, in just fake, had gone out to Mayo's. Oh, this is. And he and Mrs. Clegg stopped in Anchorage for rest. Judge Clegg wasn't able to go to make a continuous journey. And he was telling Julian about the vacancy that would be occurring up here. And he asked if Julian might not be interested in it. He said, I'd like to have you up there. And Julian came home and asked me if I wanted to live in Anchorage and in Fairbanks. And I said, certainly not. Because any place that got 40 or 50 or 60 below zero, I didn't want to have anything to do with. But we came just the same. In 24. Yes, we were there in Anchorage just 2 years.
Okay. Julian, now you told me the name of that attorney in Anchorage. Said he's 92 years old.
George Grigsby.
He's the only one alive of the old time attorney.
He's the only one alive. He was the first one. He's the oldest one. And he's past 90. I know he's old, but he's past 90.
Now, Julian, we'll play this back to see what we got, and then we'll dig some more. I want to make sure that I got it right.
That was Julian A. Hurley, and this is Harry Hughes recording for Igloo 4, Pioneers of Alaska. Julian Hurley, this is January the 26th today, and that was taken in 1960. Julian Hurley passed away last night on January 25th at Fairbanks, Alaska. And this little tape was researched for the historical records of the member pioneer.
Things.
You say my name's Sticky Griffin?
And I'm known here as Sticky Griffin. My real name is Roy A. Griffin, for information.
And I was born?
I was born in 1885 in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Come to Alaska with you?
Come to Alaska in 1925. Went outside and came back again in 1935. Opened up a candy establishment here on Cushman Street. What's that bird singing?
Mm-hmm.
And I got a parakeet that's talking to me, but he can't answer my questions. And I was established here for a number of years. And I'm a past commander of the American Legion, Dormer 8, post number 11. That means anything to anybody.
You served what war?
Huh?
You served what time in the Army?
I served in the 322nd Air Squadron in Kellyfield, Texas.
1918?
1917 and 18. Got home in 1919 and was discharged at Presidio in San Francisco. Now, out of the gold bricker for sure.
1935 to come back in this area.
In 25, I was working for Tony Zimmerman. Mrs. Zimmerman and I were relatives. He was my aunt. Tony was my uncle by marriage through her. And she's now buried on Birch Hill. Birch Hill Cemetery was through her bearings that Tony bought at Birch Hill and turned it over to the city of Fairbanks for a burial place.
Was that an outright deed or a dedicated piece of land?
Well, he purchased the land from Mr. Bentley. He bought the property on auction.
Mr. Zimmerman bought the property from Mr. Bentley and turned it over to the city?
Yeah. Some committee of some kind. I don't remember just how that was done, but anyway, it was known as Birch Hill Cemetery. She buried in that tomb right on the point out there. On the right-hand side.
How did
you
go?
Well, kind of busy. Well, I was doing more sports than baseball and basketball. I was kind of busy. I made a living, treated the kids pretty good. I had a basketball team here, and I got mixed up in baseball, and we cleaned out that old swamp down there with a senior school. Made a nice playground for kids down there. And formed a baseball league here. And we had quite a time. We enjoyed ourselves in those days. It was more fun. The work we put in was fun, so we liked it, and the whole town would turn out. We'd get singing, we want shovels and axes, and people would come down, and we'd clean out that stands and old boilers and old lumber and stove wood and stuff down there. We made a respectable piece of property out of it so it could be used for a playground, and the citizens turned out. So there was only one or two people that worked that playground over. The whole town was busy on it. Well, let him talk if he wants to talk. I can answer these questions. What's his name?
Beatty. Your tape's going on, though. You want your conversation to be in continuity.
Oh, well. Well, what else would you like to know about?
Well, how about the change in the town over the years you've been here? How was it?
I come back this time about 2 or 3 weeks ago. It don't seem the same to me anymore. I'm going to the bush.
You're going out with the old timers?
Yeah, I'm going out deep in the bush someplace. I had a business in Southern California, and I disposed of that. And I don't know why I'm here, but here I am.
Is
he just got to come home, I guess.
Would you like to mention anybody by name and leave some kind of a message on the tape for him? You know these are permanent records for Igloo number 4.
Well, there's a lot of people that I heard. Oh, I could mention dozens of them.
Would you like to hear
Jack Basil, the one. And Dixie Hall, Henry Thompson. Oh, a whole crowd of them. Bud Baker. The Bondage Brothers. Steve and George Bondage. Well, you know, that gang used to get together, and we really got things done. And Frank Nash, I seen Frank Nash and Ludrow outside before I come up there. They come down to visit me in Laguna Beach. And Frank was going to drive Ludrow to his sister's or somebody up in Alhambra. Well, I was surprised, you know, that he was passed away when I got here. See, Ludrow and I worked together one winter, the winter of 42 and 43. We was out here when they were stripping Allison Air Base for the road commission. And Greg Nash's brother-in-law, Denver, was with us that winter out there. Ludrow was my dishwasher. And Denver was my dining room girl, and of course I was the belly robber. We quite a team.
Well, we've always had a good life in Alaska.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I'm going to play this back to you.
That was a little recorded talk by Mr. Sticky Griffin, as he was known here in the early 20s and 30s. Very active in the local recreation and sports here. He's getting quite old now and decided that he would go back to the States for his retirement. On his visit here, he gave us this little story for the Pioneers of Alaska, and this is Harry Hughes recording for Igloo 4.
dated. February the 6th, 1962.
This is February the 6th, 1962. And this is Frank P. Young. I'm going to give Harry Hughes, an old friend of mine, a little of my early day history on Ladfield, which is now Fort Wainwright. Well, Harry, I went to work out there at the base in 1943. I went out there as a cutting brush for 90 cents an hour. And I worked at that for, just at labor for about a year. Until, by coincidence, I happened to bump into Major George out here at the mouth of Salt Jacket River. And the Major dropped his fly box overboard, and he had no flies to fish, and I was right by him there. I didn't know who he was. And I staked him to a few, and he caught quite a few fish, and then it started to rain pretty heavy. And anyway, one word brought on another, and we had a little refreshments to kind of warm us up. And he asked me what I was doing. I told him I was working out there cutting brush. And he said, "Well, I'm Major George. You can come up and see me sometime. Maybe I might be able to help you out." So I didn't hesitate at all about going up to see the Major, and he asked me how much schooling I had. I told him I had graduated from high school, and I had 3 years of business college in Seattle at Wilson's Business College. And he put me in as a checker down at the old civilian camp. That's the old camp that was built out there on Ladfield in 1942.
Yeah, it was the fall of 42 we worked on there.
That's right. And then I was promoted from that to housing manager. And I had charge of that camp and stayed there for about 3 years. And then I moved down to the new housing that was put up later down what we call the CBQs and the old Chena Court. And I was in the housing there, had charge of the housing on the base for approximately 10 years. And from there, I moved to the water, to a water plant out there on the base, and from there I moved to sewage disposal. And I've been in an operator in the sewage disposal plant for, I went there in 52, and I'm still there. But I figure I'm planning on retiring this coming spring if I make it that length of time.
Your experience required for that job, what did you have to do to qualify for that work?
You mean the sewage plant? Well, how I come to get into that sewage plant was through a friend of mine by the name of McDonald. He was a nephew of Joe McDonald, the old time pioneer here. He used to be United States Marshal here. And that was a kind of a deal where one pioneer was helping another. So my knowledge of supplies, he was going to make me supply man for utilities. That is, when I say supplies, for supplies for maintenance, like the janitorial service and the service of maintaining the water plants, the supplies they need, and the sewage disposal, the limes, and different chemicals, and brooms, and mops, and rags, and brushes, and what have you, to keep the place, and paints to keep the place cleaned up and looking presentable. Well, I was up on that work. I'd got into that during the time I had the housing. I also had the janitorial service out there. I used to have Hangar 1, part of the hospital, the Utilidor, the personnel building, the schools, and some more places I can't remember now, but I had about 24 or more employees under my supervision there, janitorial work, besides the housing. And I got to be pretty good at supply, that is, knowing the angles of, the supply business. If you wasn't onto it out there, you'd put in these orders and you'd be months getting them.
and I know how to carry them through paperwork and whatnot, and I... Well, anyway, through my experience in that line, when Donald, he gave me this job to in the water plant, and when I come over to take the job, there was a fellow on leave over in the sewage disposal, and he wanted to send me over there for a little while to this fellow come back. Like, kind of got things organized, and I worked over there about 18 months, and of course I couldn't help learning a little during my time there. Now, this sewage disposal worker, a good operator, he's got to kind of be familiarized with chemistry too. He's got to take these influent and effluent samples and run those every 2 hours, and a good operator, it takes him a few years to really get on to the operation of a sewage disposal plant. There's many trials and tribulations connected with the plant, that is, gases and floods, as we call them. Some of these big lift stations, sometimes their lift pumps will kick out, and then when they repair them, they'll cut loose, and it'll all come at once down in through the main sewer and into the plant. You got to know how to contend with those kind of things, and there's many more deals around a sewage disposal plant that's very dangerous for to people around it, that is, especially the operators. And one of the most dangerous deals is the gases that are around the plant that the operators got to work with at times. In regards to, for instance, myself, now I have charge of the upper digester, which these flame arresters and gas pressures and gas relief and back pressure reliefs and all that you got to be familiar with, or you might get into trouble, with the gases. And you got to be familiar also with the gas burner, know how to light them when they're out, and test the gas pressures and what have you.
Let's go through a little operation there. Now, what do you do, Frank, when your burners fail? What do you do to get set up to get going again?
Well, when you find that the gas burner's out, well, you go down first and check your gas pressure and see what your pressure is. If you got good pressure, you got to know how to light that deal so you don't blow your head off. What I mean by that is when you stick a lighted rag in there, you got to stand away from the hole where it'll, when it does light, why, it blows off just like so much gas all at once. Where,
like a blowtorch.
Just like a blowtorch, and it'll blow by you. If you stand right in front of that, you might be burnt severely. That's one of the things that you got to learn when you're operating those
now,
things.
Now, if the gas breaks down, Frank, how long a time would it be before the air would be contaminated in an area around the plant?
You mean where the gas is not being...
Simulating, yeah, if it isn't burning.
Well, that all depends on the winds shifting and the different air currents and what have you. But you take a day like when it's there's no wind and it's very dry, and those gases get pretty bad. That is, for you might say.
Are they heavy gas? Do they go down to the ground or do they go up?
Well, some of them. I guess that gas. Now you kind of got me stimulated there, Harry. I say you can smell it down on the ground, so if you can smell it on the ground, why, it must be down there. You can't see it, but...
Is it considered a heavy gas or a light gas?
Well, I should think that would be what you'd call a light gas, but it's very deadly.
What kind of gas do they call that?
Well, that's methane gas.
Methane gas?
Yes.
What's the cause of that gas? Bacteria working, or what caused it?
Oh, yeah, it's a bacteria working in digesters.
That creates the gas.
That's right.
Now, what other means of disposal of sewage do they use besides this digester? Is it a chemical process, or is it a germical process?
Well, I just didn't quite understand what you meant.
Chemical to destroy the gases and fumes and digest the sewage, or is it bacteriological or germs? There's several ways of destroying.
Yeah, well, this is bacteriological. Of course,
it uses the germs the same as the septic tank was used.
That's right, but you see, there's the BOD, that's the biochemical oxygen demand that's in the aeration tank that is putting air into water, as you understand. Then you got to have the pH on it, that is the acidity and alkaline part of it, and it's all got to be equalized to work properly.
Chemically balanced.
Chemically balanced, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. And if that goes out of balance, then it causes poison gas to escape from the plant.
If that goes out of balance, why, yes, where you're not burning the gas, it's poison gas, all right, going out. But if the air currents are right, why, it don't bother too much. But if the air happened to be,
carry for, say, for instance, a block or 2 blocks away or 2,000 or 3,000 feet away if the air current's right?
Well, if the air current's right, it'll carry a long ways. But on a dry, well, what is the word I want to use?
Humidity, heavy humidity, moist air.
Heavy humidity, that's the word. Well, anyway, on a day like that, and that gas burner's not burning, you can...
It travels fast.
Oh, yeah.
Because the moisture carries it.
Moisture carries it, that's correct.
And on a rainy day, it would, or a foggy day, it would be worse than on a dry, hot day.
Well, yes, on a foggy day, it's, I think it's a little... little bit worse.
In other words, the atmospheric pressure has a great deal to do with its dissipation over an area.
Oh, sure. You bet it does. Yeah, atmospheric
pressure.
Yes, it has a great deal to do with it, Harry.
Well, now, in your 10 years, approximately, you've been working there, has anyone else been trained to handle your job out there?
You mean other operators?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, there's quite a number of other operators. See, there's 2 sewage disposal plants out there. And anybody that operates one can operate the other, and they switch them around, what have you.
Has the city engineer consulted you from time to time in regard to this sewage disposal plant, the city engineer of Fairbanks?
Well, the city engineer has been out there, and I've seen him... consult with Mr. Wilson, that's the supervisor of utilities, that is the water plants and the sewage plants. And, well, he's talked to some of the operators. He's talked to myself and others around there in regards to the workings of the plant.
Well, Frank, you've got yourself ready for retirement now at your age. What are we going to do to occupy our time?
Well, Harry, that's the present time. If we don't think about it, that's kind of what you might say the $68 question. But we got to plan ahead. When we retire, we got to just step right into it. If we don't...
What are your desires and thoughts and wishes on it?
Well, my desires and thoughts and wishes on it are... that I'd like to work to accomplish something in regards to Pioneer Park or rehabilitating or reinstating the old Circle Trail.
Reestablishing.
I don't know my language. I can't.
That's right. Reestablish the old Circle Trail.
Yes.
For a tourist attraction.
For a tourist attraction. And,
in the wintertime, they could have dog team run, the summer horses.
Anything that would help to benefit the old timers and.
Well, there's a number of retired persons here that don't have enough to do. Well, how do you think we ought to go about getting something done about it?
Well, I think we should get into this reemployment. What is the name? Area redevelopment, yeah, that's right. You and I was over there to see him the other day, you know, Harry.
That is called a project. In other words, it's... to seed industry or development to create work.
That's right.
To create a development or a growth of an area, to settle the area.
Yeah. Well, anyway, getting into something like that to keep your mind occupied and if you work hard enough and you get the right kind of encouragement and get the thing going, if they'll give you a break on it, why, you're accomplishing something or you're trying to and you're helping yourself and others.
Well, Frank, this little visit's been very nice, and I hope it's very informative. And would you mind if I let some of the one or two of the city officials that are highly in favor of us hear your little comments? at some time or other.
Well, I have no objections to it, Harry. What I've
you
told
see,
you...
You talk better here for the recording you probably would up in front of.
Well, I don't know.
Well, thanks, Frank. That's fine.
Wednesday, February the 7th, 1962, Fairbanks, Alaska. This is a meeting of the committee on the petition in regards to the Pioneer Igloo Four Park project in the Westgate area. This petition reads, petition to the governor and legislature of the state of Alaska. We, the undersigned citizens of Alaska residing in the cities of Fairbanks, North Pole, and the greater Fairbanks area, do hereby petition the governor and the legislature of the state of Alaska as follows, to wit, first, that the suitable legislation be passed for a lease or concession to Igloo Four Pioneers of Alaska, a benevolent and fraternal organization on that tract of land in the western confines of the city of Fairbanks, said tract being owned by the state of Alaska and comprising of Lot 12 and the southwest quarter of the southwest quarter of Section 9, Township 1 South, Range 1 West, Fairbanks Meridian, and containing 72 and 64 hundredths acres for a historical museum and historical and recreational park. Second, that the said lease or concession be in the conformity with the House Concurrent Resolution number 18 passed by the House of the Legislature of the State of Alaska on March the 7th, 1961, and concurred in by the Senate April 1st, 1961. Third, that this said lease or concession be in all perpetuity. And this is composed by Irving K. Reed and Harry Hughes of the Pioneers Committee on this petition for this park project.
Now, this is Irving Reed, chairman of a committee from the Pioneers of Alaska, Igloo Number 4, to write a petition to the state legislature. Said petition is as follows. Petition to the governor and legislature of the state of Alaska. We, the undersigned citizens of Alaska, residing in the cities of Fairbanks and North Pole and the greater Fairbanks area, do hereby petition the governor and the legislature of the state of Alaska as follows, to wit. First, that suitable legislation be passed for a lease or concession to Igloo Number 4, Pioneers of Alaska, a benevolent and fraternal organization, on that tract of land in the western confines of the city of Fairbanks, said tract being owned by the state of Alaska, and comprising Lot 12 and the southwest quarter of the southwest quarter of Section 9, Township 1 South, Range 1 West, Fairbanks Meridian, and containing 72.64 acres, for historical museum and historical and recreational park. Second, that the said lease or concession be in conformity with the House Concurrent Resolution number 18 passed by the House of the Legislature of the State of Alaska on March 7, 1961 and concurred in by the Senate on April 1, 1961. Third, that the said lease or concession be in perpetuity, said resolution being drawn up by Irving Reed and Harry Hughes. Now with
transmission line 13.45 cents per square foot, which would be just about 1 cent more for the cost of putting a transmission line through. So I'd like to stand corrected on that. I think I made another mistake yesterday, and right at the moment I can't think what it was. It may have been in connection with the bill to take in state-owned lands that are encompassed by incorporated city land. Like I said, something about the League of Alaska Cities having fostered that bill, which they did not. The bill was proposed by Leo Rode, former Representative Leo Rode, that is, and the League of Alaska Cities was suggesting that cities send down a description of such property that would be included in the Fairbanks and Anchorage and other cities, city limits, it would be state-owned land, which this area is off between Westgate and Otaku subdivision, now under consideration for a potential or possible park. At any rate, the bill was proposed by Leo Rode that this be done. If there are any other mistakes, I'd like to know about them, too. Well, Fairbanks woman was attacked last evening shortly after 6 o'clock in Berry's Trailer Court, according to a police report this morning. She said that a man had grabbed her from behind and said that he didn't really want anything but for her to come with him. She struggled, and he struck her about the head and stomach. The assailant put one finger in her mouth as he was attempting to keep her from screaming. She bit down on the finger, and he let go. She then screamed, and her attacker ran to a nearby car and left the scene.